Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Chad in studio with us to begin the noon hour, to begin the second half of the show. Rick Byrd, head coach of the Belmont Bruins.
One of our favorite guests, one of Nashville's favorite guests, Rick Byrd in studio with us right now. Coach, thanks so much, first and foremost, for joining us in studio. Winning that first NCAA tournament game. We talked about it throughout the week on this show. We reacted to it the next day. All of Nashville reacted favorably to your performance and that win against Temple. Did you feel it at all in that game? Did you feel any pressure to, I don't know if it's reward the selection committee for the at-large bid, but to kind of validate that selection?
For sure, I did. And not just the selection committee, but all the people that talked about us for a week prior saying that we should be in was definitely on my mind, and I felt pressure. And I talked to the team about not the selection committee as much, really, as the people that supported us and said, hey, they're legitimately this good. They deserve to be in. I've never been sort of on the side of the mid-major versus the Power Five. I think the committee's chore is to get the best teams in. And it's hard to compare those kinds of teams with one another. And I did. And it was it probably was as much a relief as the fact that we actually got an NCAA tournament win for the first time.
Well, and you had a great shot at beating Maryland and advancing to take on LSU. You come up a basket short in that game. Now that you've had time to sort of look back and think about that whirlwind, how enjoyable was it to have that experience that not a lot of teams have of having to win that game in Dayton and then go immediately to another venue and get ready for a really good team?
Yeah, not only that, but just start on Sunday night and finding out at 5:10 or whatever it was that we're in the tournament when I think most people didn't think we were going to be, and we certainly were very unsure. And then finding out that we've got at about midnight that we got to fly out at 10 a.m. the next day. So it was getting ready for Temple and where do we practice. And that's the way it was all week. And so it's not easy. I'm sure that it's not the way you want to get your guys rest and all that. But I found out you can live on adrenaline for a long time.
Speaking of living on adrenaline, how would you rate Kevin Ingram's ability to take a hit, the physicality that he took from Emmett Williams of LSU?
You know, I think he was falling back before the contact occurred, and I think the officials wouldn't have given him the charge.
Kept the shirt, though.
Apparently, by the way, Ingram kind of undersold the effects of that hit. Like, his arm was hurting. He cracked his iPad. There was something else that was not on his body, but something else that he had was broken from that impact. It was quite the March moment, though, to relive on camera, that's for sure.
Will he be on One Shining Moment? That's what I want to know.
Hopefully we can make that happen.
We had a discussion last week, Coach, about, you know, will this help Belmont? Will this help the OVC in the future, getting the at-large and then actually getting the win as an at-large moving forward? Do you buy into that? Do you think the committee will reflect on that at all?
It's hard to tell. You don't know what goes on in that room. It can't hurt. And it's not just Belmont. It's Liberty
in
the A-Sun. It's Murray State winning big over Marquette in the first game they play. It's UC Irvine winning games, I think, that game. And I've missed a couple. So it seems like maybe more than any year, the mid-majors, the ones that actually truly deserve to fall into. Sometimes Gonzaga is still called a mid-major, and they're not, obviously. That more of those teams have won games this year.
What is your protocol for right when a season ends in terms of thinking about your future? Is there like a two-week period where you think about things and how much longer you want to do this, or is it immediately on to the next season?
I think about it every day during the season, believe me. Would it be okay if I quit this afternoon?
Once the season is over, do you go back to that in-season self, or do you start to think about all the good things?
No, it is easier to think about the good things when the season's over with, because it's a grind. It's a grind from the first game, but it's really a grind from sort of February 1 all the way through the end of your season, trying to win the next game, knowing how much each one counts. And so I think you got to reflect, at least in my case. I don't want to do it immediately. But you know, I've said this before. I'm not going to be one of those lifers. I'm not going to coach in my 70s. I've got too many golf courses I hadn't played, and I've got to get better with my backhand in tennis, and I got a new grandson that I need to see more. So I'm going to ponder on it for a little bit.
And that's where you're different than a lot of these guys. You know, you see so many coaches that it's so important to them to keep coaching, to keep having a team, to be in that locker room, and they don't really have anything else outside of whatever sport they coach. But you play tennis, you play golf, you go to the U.S. Open, you mention your grandchild also. It seems like things are different for you than a lot of other coaches you know. Do you find that to be the case?
That's my guess, because I see, and neither one is wrong or right, by the way. I mean, but I don't think Mike Krzyzewski or Roy Williams or Jim Boeheim or Bob Huggins need the money, and so they love what they do. And it may be because that's who they are, and that's their identity, and they you know, some people think, look, I'm going to find something to do. It may be work in the yard when it happens. Besides the golf and tennis and all that, but it's not nearly all that I am or what I want to be. And I'll be fine when that time comes along. Some of those guys may not be fine when they don't have that identity.
As you begin to reflect on things, like you mentioned, the off the court measures that you'll take in trying to decide what you want to do. And I'm guessing on the court, you reflect on the team you had versus the team you have returning, and how much fun you just had coaching this group versus what's likely to come up next season too.
Yeah, that kind of works both ways, because whenever it happens, I want to leave a good team. I want to leave some guys that the next coach can succeed with, and yet you think about, well, you know, maybe I better go now because it's probably going to get worse from now on. I mean, we just had a year that I did not imagine this year, and so that kind of works both ways. And the, you know, I will hurt for the fact that we recruited as a staff, but I was the head coach, and these guys came to play, and whenever I leave, There's going to be a bunch of them that are still eligible. There's going to be several of them that we just signed. I can't avoid that situation. So much as I think the world of many of those guys, I'm sure I would think the same 5 years from now.
Whenever it's time for you to retire, how do you expect the process of choosing your successor will go? You're obviously going to have input, but is that something you've thought about, that you've talked about with your administration, or something you think about at all in terms of how things move forward with the program that you've built?
I think about it, but it's really up to our president, Dr. Fisher, and Scott Corley to decide the process. I don't have any rights to helping them if they don't want my help. And I know a lot of people might think that should be the case, and I'll be happy to give them my opinion about things, but I don't expect that that's necessarily a right, and we'll see, because I mean, I've had discussions for several years about timetable and when I'm going to do it, but not specific.
We were talking about this earlier, Coach, but inconsistency in officiating, not just game to game, but half to half. Players are pretty smart about knowing what they can get away with and getting the feel for the game and knowing what's being called and what isn't. What I've seen, I feel like, more this year as opposed to other seasons, that there's almost a switch that's flipped at halftime and the game's officiated differently in that second half, and you see problems arise for that reason. Have you noticed that to be a problem at all in college basketball and games you're coaching in?
When you say differently, do you see it tighten up more often or get looser?
I see it tighten up more often than not, if that happens.
I haven't noticed that, but as we discussed, there's no question that officials get in there together and they talk about, all right, we need to start, we need to look at this closer. We need to talk of this. We need to clean up the post. We're letting guys get hands on drivers. We're not getting, there's guys shoving on offensive rebounds, and we're not getting, you know, those kind of things, which I think we would all expect them and kind of want them to do. But I don't know about a general, we're going to call it tighter kind of thing. And honestly, can't say that I've noticed it, but you have, and you got a different perspective too.
So coaches that are allowed to talk with officials and conference over the course of a game, and this was maddening to me watching Tennessee versus LSU and Tennessee versus Kentucky this year. Will Wade in Baton Rouge was allowed to delay the game because he was throwing a fit to talk to officials. John Calipari got a technical foul, and then from that point on, it's like the official decided, yeah, we'll go talk
Cal's
to you.
Cal's a master at that.
After every single call, and if I'm on the other sideline, I'm thinking, my guy's ready to shoot a free throw. Can we wrap this conference call up and get going with the game? It's not something I've seen you do a lot in a game, so I'll ask you about it. Is that something that bothers you when other coaches are allowed to spend a lot of time talking to the officials?
It is. I think that's human nature. I think the more experienced the guy that you have in the game, the less I would worry about it because they've seen it and done it all. But I just don't. I don't think it should last. The officials are pretty much taught. Okay, if it's a good time, if a guy's not going crazy, and you can go over. I mean, I had a few discussions with Doug Sermons, who's a great official in the Maryland game, and I'd say, you know, Doug, those spin moves are travels. I mean, why don't you call those? And he just kind of smiled and shakes his head, and he didn't say what he meant to say was, we don't ever call those, Rick. But they are travels, but we don't ever call them. But anything lengthy is not a good idea. I'll even take it to before a game when officials come out on the floor. I think sometimes they're too they talk to assistant coaches on the, you know, a lot now. The coaches are out there on the floor. Our guys don't go, but assistant coaches or even players on other teams, I think they need to be careful about that.
Without there being a rule change, have you noticed yourself coaching a player now differently than in years past? You mentioned the spin move and they're not calling the travel. It's not like the rule has changed on what's a travel and what's not, but are you allowing your players in practice to get away with more, knowing that they can get away with more in a game now?
A little bit, yes. In fact, Nick Musinski, our freshman post player, was sort of struggling with getting himself closer to the basket this year, and so we had him, you know, dribble it in the middle and then drop step aggressively toward the goal to get himself closer, which his is not as blatant, but if you slowed it down and looked at it, there may be times when his was a travel as well. It's funny the things they call. They'll call a guy that does a little bunny hop when he catches the ball and then makes his move, and that bunny hop really gained no advantage. It's a travel by rule. Call it. I'm okay with that. But then this other move where they'll dribble it once, pick it up, drop step another one, a 6'10 guy that's 250 pounds and is burying his guy all the way under the rim and scores it easy, and that's not called.
When did that change?
I think a lot of things. About the time that they don't ever call carrying anymore, I think that the game has evolved. It's become far more athletic, and some things from playground basketball gets into the game, mm-hmm. and then it just becomes harder to call consistently, and it just seeps incrementally into the fabric of the game. And I can still remember in a game at East Tennessee State a few years ago, several years ago, opening tip, the other team got it, threw it to a guy under the goal, he caught it, he took a left and a right and dunked it, and the official goes by, and I said, that's a travel, Doug. And he said, no, that's not a travel. What do you say to that?
Whatever you say.
By the way, breaking news now, Michael Avenatti, yes. He's been indicted by the feds for extortion with Nike in this investigation. He was extorting Nike, the one who's going to call the press conference tomorrow.
An hour after his announcement.
Yes.
There's another announcement saying he's been indicted on
charges for trying to extort Nike with whatever information he had on Nike,
and now it really is March Madness.
Now he went ahead and called the press conference anyway before the feds get to him.
What a nice guy.
I know.
Are you depressed when you see all these stories out there and what college basketball has become?
Yeah, I am. There's a lot about our game and the culture of our game that I'm not a big fan of, but I'm a dinosaur too, so I get that. I don't even like, you know, the only thing they show anymore is which teams are best on the bench in how many different ways they can make signals and strum the guitar and you know, put their shoulders and their hands up like they're strong. All that stuff is, you know, your team should be enthusiastic because you guys made good, but this choreographed kind of stuff, I don't like. I don't like players that do it on the floor after they make a three, all the stuff that goes on. We've just lost. We've lost humility. We've lost sportsmanship. We've lost not showing up the other team, way more than I like. But again, I'm old school on that stuff.
And your teams reflect that the way you feel about it. Is that because you're recruiting guys that when you watch them, they're like that and they don't act that way? Or have you recruited guys in the past that maybe acted that way after made shots and you made sure they didn't do that once they were playing for you?
There's probably some of both, but I'm going to disclaimer is I don't notice our guys on the bench, and we've got some of that going on too. And I happen to see that on a highlight film that's on our website. And I'm watching the game. I'm not seeing those guys. So it's the cool thing to do. It's cool. And that's why they do it, and I get it, and I don't want to take the fun away, but no, they understand there's some things there are standards in our program that are different than other programs, and we try to make good choices on the front end on that.
So how do you go about finding the type of players you're looking for? Can you find those players in AAU ball?
You can, because they stand out and they're different in many ways. You can in AAU basketball, but then you get to know their parents and see how they're raised and make a home visit and have them come to school either officially or unofficially. And when their parents come with them on a trip and their parents are involved in the process, then we've got a good chance and we've got a good chance of picking the right kind of kid.
Can you give us the story behind Nick Musinski? Because it's not often that you've been able to land a 6'11" guy with that type of skill and that size at Belmont. How did he sort of fall in your lap? How did you recruit him?
Best I can remember, there's a lot of kids over the years and different times, but Brian Ayers, my associate head coach, saw him play, and he was playing at one time on not so good AAU team, and he'd seen him the year before a little bit, so we put him down on the sheet, and he moved up to a good AAU team, which meant in this case he didn't play very much. And so I can remember going to Vegas and watching him play, and of course they also don't throw the ball in there very much in AAU basketball. So what I saw of him catching the ball and turning both ways and looking good on his shot, it was a little bit of a take a chance with a guy this size who looks like he's got skills and likes to play inside, and so we took a little bit of a shot, and it's probably why. I mean, there were other people recruiting him, but there was not Big Ten schools. He's from Columbus, Ohio, and so we were able to get him. And again, there was a family that was looking for things other than just, you know, what kind of shoes you wear and how many times you're on TV.
So Rick Barnes was named the National Coach of the Year by the U.S. Basketball Writers today. What do you think about the job he's done there at Tennessee, your alma mater, how he's gone about it? You're a very well-respected guy. He seems to be a very well-respected guy in coaching circles as well. Just sort of how that thing has been built with veteran guys now.
It's remarkable, really, and I didn't know that. Guess I lost out. That's kind of depressing.
They got the wrong Rick B in there. I think so. Maybe it's a misprint. It was actually Rick Bird.
You know, I think that's almost an award, don't you think, for like the culmination of this program that he's built. And it is good because he's, in some ways, he's done it like a good mid-major. He's gotten guys that are under the radar and not blue chippers, and a lot of guys with experience, and it seems like he's got a lot of good folks, good kids, leaders. Certainly Rick Barnes teams are going to be tough and physical in all the right ways. I love Rick's demeanor and the way he goes about doing his business. And he's I'm super happy for him. It's fun for me to be able to cheer for Tennessee. That hasn't always been the case in either football or basketball. and so that's great, and congrats to him.
Tennessee and Purdue on Thursday night. You saw Purdue up close this year. What do you think of them? What do you think overall of Tennessee's matchup with them and how both teams want to play?
Oh, I think it's a really good matchup. I guess my first thought is that Tennessee's potential is greater, and they've been up there in the number one in the country and top five most of the year. Purdue kind of worked their way into that with a great performance all throughout the Big Ten, and then they just played really good, obviously, against Villanova the other day. But I think personnel-wise, Tennessee has more good players. I do think Matt Painter does about as good a job of getting his team ready for a game. He's got all week to get ready for Tennessee. They defended us better than any team we played all year long. Murray did a good job in the last game we played, but we didn't have the inside presence of Musinski in that game. I would give Tennessee the edge overall, but both coaches love grinders. That both coaches love toughness. I think it will be down to the last minute or two game, no matter who wins.
You know, I was reading a little bit about Purdue today. Carson Edwards had 42 points against Villanova. You would think that's probably not going to happen again against Tennessee, but he averages almost 24 a game. And the article I read talked a lot about how he can be inefficient because everyone around him is so efficient. So he can take bad shots at times, and they have guys in position to get the offensive rebound. When he kicks it out, they have some good shooters also. Did you find that to be the case with Purdue? And how would you go about defending Carson Edwards and what he can do?
Well, you know, he's similar in a way to Ja Morant. We played the kid the other day from Maryland's an awfully good point guard. We've faced a lot. I don't think any quite as dynamic that can jump up and shoot it like Edwards could. And so you've just got to be up in him. You've got to get through ball screens, not under ball screens, and yet he can just zip by you in a heartbeat. But he will have games where he is 7 for 24, and his games, even though he may end up with 23 points counting his threes and free throws, he hasn't been very efficient. And I think that's what Tennessee has to do, make him take tougher and tougher shots.
He shoots 38% on the season from the floor.
Overall.
Overall.
Have you got twos and threes?
I'm looking for twos and threes right now. I just have overall right now. I'll find it, though.
That's not even going to probably be a effective field goal percentage of 50%, which is not very good. I think we've got five or six of our top eight players that are high 50s or above 60.
He is 34% from three.
Yeah.
85% free throw shooter.
Yeah, very good free throw shooter. 34% is right in that range where he can have a 5 for 8 day, or he can have a 1 for 12 day.
He hit 9. I think against Villanova the other night for those.
Golly,
those
I just saw bits
points.
And pieces. I didn't realize. I knew he had 42 when it was all said and done. He can do it. He gets on a roll, and he's pretty unguardable then.
How do you guard Grant Williams if you're devising a game plan for him? What are you trying to accomplish? Because we saw two different routes and similar routes from both Colgate and Iowa in mixing the zone and man, but also mixing a double team being thrown at him. How would you go about it?
Oh, you're asking me about defense?
You would just hope to get the ball back quickly so you could go score.
I would flip it around and say, why in the world don't you throw it to him every time down the floor? I mean, he's so tough and good and strong, and they usually end up doing that when the game's on the line for sure. I think you got to shove him out. Try to get position early. Keep him as far away from the basket as you can instead of letting him get in there where he's closer. And then you've either got to have guys digging to make him wonder where they're coming, or you got to go double the guy because you can't. And he's great at drawing fouls. And as we saw at Vanderbilt that night, he's pretty good at making them too. And I love watching the guy play. We're not even talking about how mentally tough the kid is.
When you see the Bryce Drew story at Vanderbilt, what are your initial thoughts when he gets fired after 3 years and the problems that they had?
Well, the initial thoughts are is 3 years fair for anybody, really, to end up getting fired? And yet we all know and understand, and all coaches know nowadays, they're getting paid a whole lot of money. And when you start losing the fan base, and particularly in a place like this where there's so much else you can do, then they're up against it. The administration's up against it to try to make the right decision. I like Bruce. He's a friend, Bryce, and I feel bad for him and his staff and their families and all that, but they also know it's a business.
Is part of this also when you look at the SEC now and you see some of the star power in coaching and you see some of these guys and the wins they have and the resumes they had coming in, does that hurt Bryce Drew a little bit that when you're struggling, you talked about kind of the appeal for the city of Nashville and making sure people are engaged and interested. Does that hurt a little bit when you look around the rest of the league and see all these great coaches?
It's hard to say what the perception of the fans are. If Bryce Drew or anybody else had come in here and they start winning games in a big way, they're going to be excited. I mean, Will Wade wasn't the biggest name in the world, and we probably don't want to get on all that. But when they started winning big at LSU, it was fine that he came from where he came from. Mm-hmm. And it's more just about winning and getting it going and getting excited about the program, I think, than it is that. Although, you know, when Bruce Pearl went to Auburn, you know, Bruce Pearl's got something about him that people get excited about. He's willing to do about anything and say anything to get people fired up. And there's no question that helped Auburn catch fire down there in that arena and their fan base and all that.
Rick Byrd with us here on the Midday 180.
Is it frustrating when you see the reaction of Tom Izzo coaching a guy hard and that people had a real problem with it and wanted him to be disciplined?
I've only been told about it. I didn't see it. It is frustrating in some ways. I think I've crossed the line. I'm raising my hand here at times when I'm frustrated in the middle of the moment and wish I hadn't gone about it in the way that I did go about it when I was angry. But if you know, Tom Izzo's program is like it is because he has standards and expectations, and they should know that when they go in. They do know that. It's usually not the players who are too upset. It's people from the outside looking in. I don't think you ought to verbally abuse kids. I don't think, you know, we don't allow profanity in our program. When it happens, it's very disappointing to me. It doesn't happen from our staff, and I don't think you should be able to do any of that kind of stuff. But challenging kids is part of what makes them better, part of what makes your team better. And I can promise you from experience, some of the kids I've challenged the most and had the most face-to-face, let's just disagree with one another here for a few minutes, come back years later and they appreciate you more because you were tough on them.
Story we talked about earlier, Admiral Schofield basically says he doesn't want to go back in the game in overtime yesterday because Kyle Alexander was playing better defensively and he had four fouls, even though Rick Barnes wanted him to go into the game. Rick Barnes pointed that to how selfless he is. He also said at times, guys that are veterans have a better feel for the game than the coaches on the bench, and if you trust them, you have to listen to them at times. Have you ever had a situation like that in your coaching career where a guy, especially a senior who hit two big shots in the previous game, opted out of a game late?
No, I haven't.
What would your reaction be to that?
I guess probably a little different than Rick's was. And I'd say, well, if you don't want to go in, I sure don't want to put you in. We talked earlier about that, and I was watching it at a restaurant with no sound, and it's another thing I noticed. There he is on the bench, and I knew he hadn't fouled out. But you know, the kid's been around a long time. He's a great leader. Give him credit. If he thinks that was best for the team and that's why he did that, if that's all true and accurate, good for him.
My takeaway was I can get on board with the storyline that it was for the team and it was very unselfish one time like that. But if it happens again, then I'm questioning whether or not you want to be in there.
Well, you always want kids that want to be in there. That's what you want. And so it's unusual, but you know, we don't we don't know the story for sure. We don't know.
That's right.
And we'll just take them for what it's worth. And they won the game, didn't they? He made the right call.
That was Chad's one. It worked, so you can't really question it.
Coach, the game planning for a team in this tournament, describe for us the quick turnaround you have to have, the trust you have in your staff, which you do all year long, but I would imagine the fast turnaround. The last time you joined us, you said you hadn't even watched Maryland yet.
Right.
After your win over Temple. Just take us through step by step how you go about preparing for your opponent in the tournament when you're playing a day and a half later.
Right. Like we found out Sunday night, 5:15, and we're going to play them on Tuesday night. But we need to have a good practice on Monday. It's way more about getting ready for the practice than it is. People think, well, you got 2 days. Well, no, you don't. You've got to be ready. You have to have your game plan and set for the day before, so you can, when you actually can practice, you go through it. Tyler Holloway became the main scout for Temple. Other guys pitched in and watched certain games, sent him clips. Let me back up to everybody in our business has got a system, and there's Synergy is a company that has all the games, and you can go on there and you can watch every out of bounds play that Temple ran all year long, or every zone defensive set on defense.
It's all separated.
Yes, it's all separated, and it's separated even into pick and roll actions, or into post up actions, or one on one. So those guys watched three of their games, mostly for their offense. I watched and another, myself and one other staff member, watched their defense. I usually spend more time on the other team's defense, trying to figure out how we're going to score, and I rely on the staff more for putting together all their actions that they run, and then I'll look at that and see if we need to tweak how we're going to guard this action or do that. But because it's all there now, it's much easier than it used to be. So you can be ready that quick. And then when we won the game, we had to fly all night, and we had to have a public practice at about 5:00 on Wednesday before the Maryland game. And then we went to a high school gym, but all we did then was, as you can imagine, was simply walk through what Maryland does, because those guys, Dylan Winter, played 40 minutes the night before, and we'd gotten on a plane and took off at 2 a.m. in the morning, and we just weren't going to do anything live. So that was a real different day. I don't like it when we don't have a chance to go live from an offensive perspective, because a team may be playing ball screens or the post, much different than the game the night before. But hopefully we've seen it somewhere during the year, and we can tell them that this is what they do. It's like what Eastern Kentucky does, or it's like what Murray State does.
Take us through that final offensive play against Maryland, because it looked like the play was there. The defender made a really good play on the ball on the back cut from Dylan Windler. But the decision to slow it down and go for that last shot, is that something you normally do, or is that just a feel of the game type moment that you wanted to go ahead and try to end it with that last shot?
I think that, first of all, it's not the same play that we ran against UCLA, but it's the same decision we made. And in an odd way, it was similar, because in both cases we had a timeout when the other team had the ball or were shooting. In other words, we came down with the ball and didn't have to call timeout and tell them what to do, because we had already done it in the previous timeout. And so we get the ball. In this case, we thought we were going to get the ball with more than 30 seconds left. And I can't remember what happened on the other end to create a situation where we got it with right at 29 or something. And that's a gut call. If you've got a play that you think has got a better than 50-50 chance of working, and you're playing a team that is kind of maybe supposed to be better than you, then I think you roll the dice and you take a chance. I didn't like the chance of us stopping them on the other end, either initially or keeping them from getting the offensive rebound and beating us down the other end, because you can pretty much count there is no offensive rebounding fouls when it's the last second shot. And
saw that in the Duke game. Yes, we did.
So we ran a play that was similar to the play at UCLA, And I've watched it, and I think the window was there. I think had the pass not been deflected, and now we're talking about slightly deflected, then I think it would have been finished. You know, you don't know. There was a good defender on Dylan, but he got a pretty good little window ahead, and it's just something you got to call. It doesn't bother me. Some people would say you should. You just don't go for the win and lose the game because you did it.
And I was saying that. I thought you extend the game in that moment just to give yourself a second opportunity, possibly.
Right, and that's the thought process behind it. But then, you know, if you don't get it, then you do foul, and you may get another chance. But if you do get it, you win. So I don't know
you
how
went
to compare
for it.
Those
I mean,
odds.
Yeah, you
and
went it, for
and it.
It
did work. It, you say our guys were totally on board. They believed in the play and the decision, I think.
Coach, if you're in studio with us 10 years from now and we ask you about this season and this team, what do you think you'll bring up first?
Well, that's a good question. I think it'll be one of the most enjoyable, maybe as much as any team we've ever had, overachieving teams. I did not expect this to be the first team to ever win an NCAA tournament game. I did not expect 27 wins.
What do you think realistically you felt like this team could achieve?
I thought if we could get 20 wins on the year plus, that'd be a really good year. I didn't know it would only take two losses to tie for the conference championship. I maybe thought we could be in the hunt for a conference championship, but I would have thought that we're talking about four losses for each team in that mix, and Murray and us ended up with two. And it's just the combination of senior leadership with Kevin McClain and Dylan Windler and freshman energy and enthusiasm was really interesting to watch, and I think it carried our team because we needed both.
You still have a lot of energy for this, I know. We discussed in the first segment you contemplating what you want to do moving forward. Are you really towing the line there on if you come back or if you don't, if you want to retire or if you don't?
Probably wouldn't announce it here if I didn't know what I was going to do, would I? I'm thinking about both options right now. But I've been doing that for the last year or two. So, no, I do have. I think I'm physically capable of coaching, but I don't want to fail to have healthy years of retirement either.
Rick Bird has been our guest. We always love when you come in. Hopefully this will not be the last time this offseason.
Anytime.
That you'll hop in studio with us and break down the game.
Masters preview.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
He can tell the story he told us during the break about the 1971 Masters and how he and his buddy affected the outcome. I've got the highlights from that tournament. I'm going to try to find the exact shot.
Okay.
We'll tell that. This is the perfect tease for the next time he joins the studio. We'll tell that story next time.
These people listening do not care about that segment.
No, you always leave them wanting more, Coach. Always leave them wanting more. That story coming up next time Coach Bird joins us in studio.
Coach, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Rick